Very warm welcome to you all to this Cheapside debate. At least you've all got plenty of room. It's a delight to have you all here. A member of my congregation, very sophisticated, devout, and extremely practical, quizzed me about what on earth the Lambeth Conference was for. My heart sank somewhat, and mercifully she'd lost interest by the time I managed to call her with a stumbling explanation. But I sense her question was something like, why on earth would an institution put itself through all of this? And of course, at the outset, it might be wondered why the conference takes place at exactly 10 yearly intervals, and why the Archbishop of Canterbury doesn't summon it at a time of maximum convenience to him, as would, of course, a Prime Minister or indeed a Pope. At a party for bishops at Buckingham Palace, a London parish priest of my acquaintance, who astonishingly happens to be in this church today, was accosted by the Duke of Edinburgh as to why he wasn't wearing purple. "But, sir, that is because I'm not a bishop." "Well," came the response, "what the hell are you doing here then?" Which may raise questions about who was invited, and not least of all laypersons, only bishop spouses. Stories of connubial bishops moving their wives' beds into their student bedrooms must have played amusingly in the Vatican. Well, for all my reservations, it has to be admitted that Lambeth was a greater success or less of a disaster than had been widely predicted. And some considerable credit perhaps ought to be accorded to the Archbishop for that. Others have suggested, though, that the conference was excessively staged and managed, and that the press was unreasonably kept at bay. To discuss these and other thoughts, we have two friends of mine, that is, and shortly perhaps of each other. Humphrey Southern has served as a parish priest in Kent, inner city Liverpool, suburban Surrey, and rural Wiltshire, and has been Bishop of Repton in the Diocese of Derby for 2 years, and of course was at the conference. He has written illuminatingly and helpfully on the writings of Dr. Rowan Williams, and by contrast, disapprovingly of the growth of Calvinistic Anglicanism in Sydney and its diaspora in parts of this city. And he has the rare distinction of having had me as his best man. Stephen Bates is one of the most distinguished of British journalists, and only one of two to whom I will speak off the record. He is a staff writer at The Guardian. As formerly its religious affairs and royal correspondent, he was named UK Religious Writer of the Year in the Church's Media Council Awards in 2005 and 6. He is a keen and incisive observer of the religious scene and the author of several books, including A Church at War, Anglicans and Homosexuality, and God's Own Country, Religion and Politics in the USA. Humphrey.
Thank you very much for your introduction, and it's very good to be here. I couldn't help reflecting as I came that it's interesting to be here in the City of London at this precise moment, reflecting on another dysfunctional and collapsing institution, the Anglican Communion. I want to start with the Lambeth Conference 1998, at which I wasn't in any capacity. And at the risk of fulfilling an awful lot of stereotypes, I want to start with a very famous, nay, infamous resolution on the subject of sexuality. Not because I want to talk about sexuality per se, but because it sets a very useful scene. It was, of course, the Resolution 110, which did two things. By it, the bishops at the Lambeth Conference 1998 committed themselves to discovering sympathetically and listening to people who were homosexual. And at the same time, they committed themselves to not ordaining people who were homosexual to the order of bishop. Within 5 years, one Anglican archbishop publicly had described homosexual people as lower than animals, And in another diocese, as we all know, an actively homosexual man was elected to the episcopate and consecrated to that office. I use that familiar bit of story as indicating what a broken institution, in a sense, the Lambeth Conference was. Deeply ineffectual. There are plenty of other resolutions and decisions that it and others made which have similarly been wholly ignored. It's just that's a particularly glaring example. So I want to start with the idea the Lambeth Conference as a method of expressing the mind of the church is and has been ineffectual. What I also understand, and perhaps Stephen and others who were there in 1998 would either be able to confirm or challenge, is a view that in fact it was also, in many ways, a very unbecoming process. It was highly politicized, lots of resolutions and sharp and unbecoming debate. So I think that when the Lambeth Conference for this year was being planned, there was a need to acknowledge that as it had been, it should not be. And that was why a very different kind of conference was designed. Very quickly, I think that the differences were about, first of all, a number of new features. Before the conference, there was a period of hospitality offered to bishops from across the world in dioceses in England and Wales, Scotland and Ireland. So there's an important stuff about the building of relationships. The conference itself began, as one might think all should do, with a period of silence and quiet and retreat. Some prayer. It's a rather obvious thing to do at the beginning of a religious gathering, but it's surprising that it hadn't happened before. As far as the process of the conference was concerned, a model was adopted, I don't know how genuinely, from African society called Indaba. The word is a Zulu word, and it means, as far as I can make out, endless conversation, in every sense of the word, endless. A conversation which goes on without resolution, without conclusion. And this happened in groups of 40 bishops at a time, growing out of smaller gatherings daily for Bible study, which was a feature of the conference which had happened before. And I think that process of discussion without resolution was essential to the method, building on that idea of relationship rather than conclusion. That said, there were some product as well as process. There was some product as well as process. I think that I would pick on perhaps three areas. One is the one day that the bishops, most bizarrely, all dressed up to go to a garden party at Buckingham Palace, and on the way, as it were, had a significant march through Westminster supporting the Millennium Development Goals and a rally addressed by the Prime Minister at Lambeth Palace. As I say, this large purple procession, the wives in summer hats, looked a rather odd kind of political occasion. And I have to say that the irony of a march against hunger and oppression sandwiched between two events in palaces was not lost on anyone. But that was one part of the product. Another part of the product, I think it would be true to say, is a document called the Reflections document, very different and rather more lightweight than the kinds of resolutions that previous Lambeths have produced. This was a distillation of some of the conversations which took place in these Indaba sessions. And it was written as we went along. There was a lot of cynical expectation that, of course, when you have a document like that, you can write it before. But in fact, as far as I can make out, it was quite carefully written as we went along, and people were able to hear their voices in it. Perhaps the least satisfactory part of the conference, because the most like the old, were those bits where people were able to talk in plenary and make points contributing to that document, and that was where one heard some very familiar voices indeed. But I think I won't be any more specific than that. Familiar voices saying familiar things. And the third bit of product is perhaps the most fragile, and it is the so-called moratoria, three moratoria that the conference has committed itself to. First, a continuing moratorium on the election and consecration of bishops in same-sex unions. Second, a continuing moratorium on the publication of rites to bless same-sex unions. And thirdly, a moratorium against incursions into other dioceses by bishops unsympathetic to any aspect of the policy in a neighboring diocese. They are very fragile. All we can say about those moratoria is that they have held thus far. And I, for one, am by no means convinced that they will hold forever. But in a sense, what they provide, arguably, is a space for that kind of endless conversation to continue in other forums and in other gatherings. I think there's one other thing that I'd want to say as part of this introduction, which relates to this Indaba process. Apparently, where Indaba happens in African villages, there's a very important role for the chief, who from time to time during the conversation has to say, this is where we've got to. And as you know, the Archbishop has been hugely criticized from all sorts of sources for showing a lack of leadership in the past. I think from where I sat, I saw him exercising that role of articulating on three major occasions during the conference, once at the beginning, once at the end, and once in the middle, the state of the conversation as he was hearing it. And in so doing, I think, showed a kind of leadership that he has not been credited with before. And if we had more time, I'd perhaps be able to reflect on that a little bit longer. I said that was the last thing I was going to say. I'll say one more, because I want to get this in first, as it were. I think an important thing that the Church, the Anglican Communion, and probably the Church of England need to learn is to be a little bit nicer to the press, to the media, who I think were treated shamefully during the conference. And I think that was a very foolish policy, as well as a rather unpleasant one.
Very good segue.
Goodness, consensus and agreement breaks out at the first opportunity. thank you very much, George, for inviting me. I think I see a pattern of continuation in your Duke of Edinburgh story, because a few years ago the press were invited to a reception at Windsor Castle, at which the royal family came amongst us and chatted to various journalists who they would not normally give the time of day to. And the Duke of Edinburgh accosted the editor of The Independent. The Independent, as you know, a newspaper which doesn't mention the royal family if it can avoid it. And the Duke said, "What are you doing here?" And the editor of The Independent said, "Well, I was invited." And the Duke said, "Well, you didn't have to come." I have to say, I didn't have to go to the Lambeth Conference this year because I gave up writing about religious affairs on a daily basis about 6 months before that. I'd decided that I'd had enough. I'm not in a position to give a first-hand account from behind the barbed wire, which I gather the press were corralled behind. And I'm not in a position to say how much access they had. I gather not very much, and I'm very grateful for what Humphrey said about the way the press were treated. I must say that considering the media operation had been planned with considerable ingenuity for at least 18 months before the conference took place, it was surprising that they adopted the way of dealing with the media that they did, because they certainly consulted fairly widely about it. I was speaking to one diocesan, senior diocesan bishop of the Church of England last week, and he said it was the most controlled of the three Lambeth conferences that he'd attended. I spent the previous 7 years covering virtually every single meeting of the Anglican Communion, all of which, I have to say, I think without exception, were subsumed into a discussion of sexuality and a conflict about that. And one of the reasons I gave up reporting about religion was because I got rather sick of the endless arguments. I was at the Canadian Churches Synod in Winnipeg for my sins about 18 months ago, and as they went through the endless rigmarole about human sexuality, a Canadian journalist sitting next to me turned to me excitedly and said, "This is really fascinating, isn't it?" And I said, "Not when you've heard the debate on three continents, it's not." And I must say, I'd heard the arguments quite a lot. I think the process that Humphreys described as a means of attempting to reach consensus, something I know that Archbishop Rowan is very keen on and is very central to his mission and his leadership of the church, sometimes gives the impression to outsiders that it's a means of progress of a church which has lost its confidence and self-confidence. And that wouldn't matter, these endless debates and this endless failure to reach consensus in a private club among, if I may say so, consenting adults in private. But this is the established Church of England. It's the third largest Christian denomination in the world. And indeed, it's one which has a sizable media operation. There are certainly more press officers and PR officers at Church House than there are journalists covering the Church of England these days. And of course, as we know, the church makes ardent efforts continuously to present itself as relevant and, dare one say it, sometimes with it. And of course, as Humphreys indicated, its million weekly congregants obtain their information about what's going on in the church from the media. We are the conduit of information in a way that the church itself actually can't be, because it has different priorities. In Bernard Ingham's charming phrase, we are the sewer, not the sewage. Humphrey has spoken very eloquently about this conference, and I, from what I've seen, I wouldn't disagree with any of that, but I want to address the wider question of where the church goes now. I think there's a need to jerk out of this endless cycle and circle of consideration of this matter, because this is certainly not a controversy which has been got up by the media. It's something that's been fermented within the church. It's something that the factions within the church have got very obsessed by. And indeed, the moratoria that Humphrey spoke about have already been broken. I don't think from the more extreme factions that there was any intention ever of observing them. It's not something that the media has got up. Indeed, the media has been rather unconcerned about it. I found it increasingly difficult to write about or to get my news desk interested in over the years, because everyone had heard the debate rather endlessly and it never came towards a resolution. I'm not saying that there must be a decisive resolution, but I think there needs to be a means of pushing the thing forward. And as we know, the factions within the church are fighting a battle over power, not theology or doctrine. This is actually a power struggle which is going on about how the church should conduct itself, and indeed who should be members of the church. And it's at times a very distasteful battle. We only have to, as we're standing here in the City of London, think of St. Helen's Bishopsgate down the road, where the vicar wouldn't allow Rowan Williams anywhere near his pulpit because he might infect the congregation with false doctrine. We need to think of Oak Hill, one of the theological colleges just outside London, which is so militantly, conservatively evangelical these days that its vice principal organized separate prayer room so that those of tender conscience should not have to hear Rowan Williams lead prayer at the evangelical gathering a couple of years ago. And we know of Peter Jensen, the Dean of Sydney, Humphrey mentioned Sydney, where the revolt is being fomented most strongly at the moment. Peter Jensen, who in my presence once described King's College Chapel, of all places, as a temple of Baal, because they sell CDs of the choir in the antechapel. These are things which are extraordinary in world Anglicanism these days, and they're going on. And as we've seen, they're nowhere near a resolution, despite Archbishop Rowan's best endeavors. They're not being resolved because one side does not wish to be appeased. It wants victory. Rowan sometimes gives the impression that it's all six of one and half a dozen of the other. Actually, there's only one side in this debate which is demanding victory and repentance of the others and demanding expulsion of the others, and that's the conservative evangelical side. And it's a side which has gained more strength than it has numbers, but is very influential, certainly in the United States, and overall, of course, in Africa. There's been, as Humphrey said, from the 1998 conference 10 years ago, 10 years of a commitment to listen and to talk and to discuss. And there's been very little agreement even to disagree. No live and let live, no agreement on whether this particular aspect of human sexuality is a first or second order issue, no agreement on whether it's a sin or not. If you want a contentious question at General Synod during the question time to bishops, you should do, as is occasionally done, stand up and ask a bishop whether he regards homosexuality as a sin or not. It's utmost difficulty in answering that question these days. No agreement, for instance, on traditional provincial autonomy, and no sanctions as yet, and maybe never, against border incursions. Instead, there's a sort of paralysis and constipation within the church. And that's fine, too, for a private club. It's a sense of ennui that I think characterizes Rowan's approach to leadership, a collegiate approach which is admirable, but not a leadership approach which he finds, I think, fastidiously difficult and contrary to his natural character and inclinations. Someone once said to me that the trouble with Rowan is he's too damn Christian towards some of these people. And I think there's a truth in that, a reluctance to see the bad things in men who are quite malign towards him and say awful things about him and quite determined to wrest control of Anglicanism in a direction which will change its shape and change its nature in a way that people in the pews as yet probably don't recognize. The church presents itself as obsessed with this issue. We report it, but it can't stop talking about it. And it finds itself increasingly out of touch with, certainly in this country, the rules and the regulations by which civilized society is conducted. Civil partnerships legislation, employment legislation, equality legislation, all of which the church seems to seek to obtain exemptions from. The conservative evangelicals are quite surprised that they get relatively little outside support during the crisis over the appointment of Geoffrey John to the bishopric at Reading 5 years ago now. They were really quite concerned that they didn't get editorial support from newspapers that they thought they should have done, like the Daily Mail and the Sun. A complete lack of interest from those papers. They took this as more evidence of their beleagueredness and the fact that if everyone else was against them, they must be right. As I say, a private club can live with this. The established church, a church which seeks to proselytize, to gain adherence because it has a message of good news, can't afford to carry on in the way that it is. George, I think I should stop there.
Thank you both very much for that clarity. Now there's an opportunity for us to engage in something closer to a conversation, and Matthew will have a roving microphone for people to use. So if you would kindly think of different questions, that would be splendid. I wonder if I could just ask both of you, really, where you think that means that the Church of England within the Anglican Communion now belongs. Because we're also, of course, part of another communion. We don't happen to have an archbishop who's the president of it, the Pourvu Communion of Reformed and Episcopal Churches, where some of these issues that we've been talking about play out rather differently. And then on the other side, it occurs to me that for all the slightly chaotic and uncertain decision-making processes which you, Steve, have adverted to, this is wholly better than the Church of Rome, which has a very positivist and deeply hierarchical and non-lay way of doing things. I'm just wondering whether there's anything there you can comment on.
Thank you. I mean, I think one of the things reflecting on Stephen's presentation is that he moved fairly seamlessly to and fro between comment on the Church of England and comment on the Anglican Communion. And I think it's probably quite important to keep a clear distinction between those two things in our minds. One of the things that the conference brought home to me was that a lot more about the nature of communion, and that there is no such thing as the Anglican Church, but there are a series of churches in communion with one another, different degrees of shakiness to that communion, and what holds us together or what drives us apart as churches from one another is part of the process that we were addressing in the conference. I think the other thing that it would be very easy to get the impression of, and I take full responsibility for starting with this, is that the conference was all about sex. In fact, it wasn't, and only to a very limited extent were those old and tedious arguments re-rehearsed, because like Stephen, I think the rest of us have moved on and are just plain bored of it. I was quite involved in a completely different life a little while ago with the debate about fox hunting. I think this debate about sex in the church and the debate about fox hunting have got this in common. They have been the two least well-conducted bits of debate in the public forum that I can possibly imagine. What they had in common was two sides who simply wouldn't and couldn't hear one another. And in a sense, what the conference was about was trying to help people to hear one another as a bond of communion in that sense. So I think that I would agree with you that we do have, we do exist in other associations as well, and we need to pay attention to that. I'm not an expert on the Pourvu relationships at all, but it's a different kind of communion. It's a different kind of unity. And what we were having to do was trying to explore whether there was such a thing as unity amongst Anglicans. I think debates about the Church of England are perhaps easier to describe, and I'm again, at the risk of too much unanimity breaking out for a healthy debate, I have to say I agree very largely with almost everything Stephen said about the implications of being an established church, that we're not a private club, we're not a private association, we have a national responsibility, a social responsibility there. And I would agree with that. I just would be very cautious about that particular bit of culture then being applied to the debates of the communion as a whole.
I'm sure that's right. I just feel that so many of the forces in Anglicanism worldwide are moving in an opposite direction to that at the moment. There's an insistence not on regional or provincial autonomy, but on a conformity, things you agree on, things that you can discipline other people about. And the Anglican Covenant, the palsied progress towards such a document or such a framework illustrates that this is a trend within the church that certainly some, I suspect, more evangelical parts of the church wish to move towards. And the great genius of Anglicanism, generally, as we know, is its allowance for personal autonomy and provincial autonomy, forms of worship. You can see that even so in the sort of conservative insurgency. Archbishop Jensen in Sydney says he would never enter a church where there was a mass being said, which would come as a surprise to the American conservative Episcopalians, who are extremely high church. And indeed, Gene Robinson, the gay bishop, is one of the most evangelical of the American bishops. So these things are tugging in different directions. And if we confuse the Church of England and the Anglican Communion sometimes, that's because there are similar insurgencies going on. What is happening in the worldwide communion is actually mirrored and may yet come to pass in the Church of England. There are certainly forces within the Church of England that would like to enforce a conformity of view and belief. Reading some of the documents of organizations like Reform, the conservative evangelical movement, you see something, language even, which is very similar to the militant tendency in the Labour Party in the 1980s. How to subvert your parish church, how to take over the parish council. Things which seem extraordinary to me. They may have developed and come and gone over the centuries in Anglicanism and in the Church of England, but which read very quaintly, as even the Labour Party has moved away and has dealt with those sorts of insurgencies. The centrifugal force in Anglicanism is something which those who believe in a variety of worship and doctrine and theology and theological styles need to be very aware of, because their opponents are very intolerant of that. They don't believe in it, and they don't like it, and they want it stopped.
The senior curate of St. Helen's Bishopsgate said to me that he was coming to this debate. On the whole, I'm rather glad he didn't. Now, over to you. Any thoughts, comments, or questions? Sir?
Just wondering if what impact, if any, the evangelical gathering in Jerusalem and the non-attendance of evangelicals at Lambeth, did that affect the conference proceedings? Would there have been a different outcome for the conference if those events hadn't happened, or would it have been the same?
Very useful question. Yeah. The question about whether the evangelical conference that happened in Jerusalem before the Lambeth conference and the non-appearance of other evangelicals, whether that had an impact or not.
I think we've got to be quite careful about describing it as an evangelical conference, because I don't think GAFCON was. I think it had that it was a conservative conference. That's what the participants had in common. And I think, as Stephen's just indicated, that is a very strange and motley alliance. That conservative alliance, which includes a very broad breadth of very conflicting theological and other positions. Of course, there were quite a lot of people, quite a large number of bishops who were at both the GAFCON conference and the Lambeth conference, which says something for their stamina, if nothing else. It also said something about bishops spending all their time going to conferences, I suppose. But I think that was quite important. I mean, and I was having dinner with one of the evangelical English bishops who was at both GAFCON and Lambeth. And some of the things that he was saying in terms of interpretation and communication were very, very important. I think, and for me, that helped me to remember that it's not suitable, really, just to simply to tar the whole of that GAFCON group with the same brush, as it were, as all being negative and about wanting to break things up. I think there is quite a lot of truth in that amongst some of them, but I don't think it's true for all. So there were quite a few who were at both. The official line about those who weren't at Lambeth, which I subscribe to, is that Lambeth was the poorer for them not being there. How much difference it made, it's really, I think, very, very difficult to say. If we'd had a large number of Conservatives, if we'd had all of the Nigerians there, for instance, it's hard to imagine, just simply because of their numbers, that they wouldn't have made an effect. But there's something about the process which was not about conclusion, which may have been robust enough simply to hold them in conversation. But that's one of the sort of great what-ifs of history, as it were. I think that it's for the very comprehensiveness of Anglicanism that Stephen has spoken about so eloquently and that I would want to support entirely, for that comprehensiveness to continue, we do need to continue those conversations. GAFCON and Lambeth, in a sense, need to speak to each other. They need to draw back together for a comprehensive conversation. Otherwise, the kind of comprehensiveness we get will be the comprehensiveness of the Liberals. I'm one, but there are a lot of people who are in the church who aren't and need to, who are not liberals, but need to be in the conversation. And I think that's the danger of simply, if I may say so, presenting the things entirely in the terms that Stephen's used.
Steve, you can't possibly agree with that.
I don't entirely. I must say, last week I was sent in the post the latest journal of the Church Society, which, as you know, is an ancient conservative evangelical group, which in its lengthy reporting of GAFCON and the implications of GAFCON, the Conservative Conference in Jerusalem, published a photograph of a service during GAFCON which showed an African priest raising the host at communion and said, this is a sort of thing we've got to stamp out of from GAFCON. Raising the host is papist idolatry. So there is a certain clash of civilizations going on within the conservative movement as well. I think the trouble is that what Rowan wanted to do with the Lambeth Conference, the conversation, is something they just don't want to have. I'm not sure that all the people on the Liberal side always want to have the conversation, but they do at least wish to stick with the others. Gene Robinson always says, I am convinced that one day Peter Akinola and I will be sitting side by side in heaven. And then he pauses and says, I say that partly because I believe it to be true, and partly because I know it will annoy him so much. and I think there are elements in that. While the forces of conservatism are separate and diverse, but united internationally, then they are strong. When they actually have to engage closely with each other, let alone with the broader church, then they have problems. And I think the stayaways, who numbered a number of English bishops as well, including the bishop of the diocese where I live, Michael Nazir Ali, were showing that they don't wish for dialogue, they don't wish to admit to uncertainty or to admit to being open to other thoughts and other interpretations. Not being converted to them, but being open to them, to being open to discuss them. And I think that that's a very serious and very sad problem, both for the Church of England, where there are a number of bishops who have been undermining the Archbishop of Canterbury, and in the wider Anglican Communion. They foment trouble, and that is a very unchristian thing to do. My evangelical wife, who is a charismatic evangelical, but a very devout one, always says the trouble with these people is that they don't read their Bibles because they know nothing of love or charity, and I rather suspect that's true.
Another question. Yes.
Thank you very much. I think one of the characteristics of the live and let live approach within the Church of England is that it opens itself up for ideas with which one would normally kind of disagree with. So you are by the very nature of the communion opening yourself up for the things that the likes of Peter Akinola have said, and I think there's a danger for us as Christians and for people on the outside looking into when we've got global warming, world poverty, war, for us to seem so obsessed with our own internal wranglings, to me seems to do more harm than good. And at what point do you say that we should perhaps have an amicable divorce and for the good of everybody?
Yes. Who would like that one?
I think part of the difficulty is it'd be very, very difficult to know what an amicable divorce would look like in these circumstances. I think that you could see it to an extent within the Anglican Communion. In a sense, it's begun to happen through this Fellowship of Confessing Anglicans. However, it would be very difficult to see how such a divorce would happen structurally, could happen structurally within the Church of England. And I think that that's a debate in itself. And whilst, as I say, it's important to keep a clarity that the Church of England is not the Anglican Communion and the Anglican Communion is not the Church of England. As Stephen's pointed out for us, things that play out in the debates of the Communion play out also in the debates of the Church of England, as indeed within pretty much all Anglican churches, perhaps not the Diocese of Sydney, where there's not much debate about anything, it has to be said. I think that for that reason, divorce simply is still not really an option, and we do need to have a conversation which continues. The cost to that is the criticism that we never conclude, we never decide anything, you don't know what Anglicans stand for. That's a criticism that, after all, we're very used to, and I think probably need to continue to be prepared to accept. Also, we need to take the risk that the conversation will sometimes become extremely toxic and unpleasant, and we do have to listen to some pretty repellent things said by the likes of Peter Akinola, and we do need to hear that. I think that the danger of silencing and drowning out the voices that we don't like really is a danger that's a real one. And so a comprehensive debate will allow all voices, even the ones we really most dislike hearing, to be heard.
Do you think a divorce is reasonable?
Well, I suppose I'm slightly absolutist in my theology. I'm a Catholic for my sins. And I do have a tendency to feel that if you can't live with each other, if you cannot debate with each other, then perhaps you're better off finding a means of coexistence which doesn't involve unity, because clearly you don't have unity. There's a sense, though, in which the evangelicals will the means but not the end. Both sides are reluctant to leave the table, and pretty nakedly, certainly in America, where the dispute is largely devolving into a debate about and a legal dispute about property, there's a reluctance to leave the safety of the Episcopalian harbour, and not least to divest themselves of the property. The evangelicals have been quite open about this for many years, as in the 1960s, when their conference decided to engage with the Church of England, they were talking about the church being a convenient boat to fish from. That's the great phrase about it. And it's jolly cold outside. They don't have the access or the status or necessarily the property that they would wish to use. And I think that is, if there's a centrifugal force keeping them inside rather than driving them spiraling outside, I think that's pretty central to it. They would lose more than they sense they would gain outside the church. The current debate, insofar as it is a debate, is a very strange thing. One conservative evangelical, Kendall Harmon of South Carolina, described it best to me, I think. He said, it's like playing tennis on two contingent courts. You hit the ball over the net, but there's no one to hit the ball back. There is no engagement. And that's because they think there is no need for engagement because they are right. And that lack of humility is a very dispiriting thing.
So why were their spouses there?
Search me, mine wasn't.
Was it a useful addition?
The conferences were effectively separate. So what the spouses did and what we did had very, very little connection with each other. We all went to tea with the Queen and marched for the Millennium Development Goals, and there was one session where we were very artificially and I think rather manipulatively brought together to reflect on domestic violence. But apart from that, interestingly enough, I know little of what happened in the Spouses Conference, and it would be very easy for me to make sort of caricaturish generalizations about it. For myself, I think that I think the way that you put it at the beginning was very telling of all, as a category of important lay people. I'm not sure that one would necessarily first think of bishops' spouses as the ones that you would gather. However, that's a pretty Church of England observation, it has to be said. The way that I think some other Anglican bishops' ministry is shaped and worked in other parts and other cultures does actually involve quite a significant role for their wives. And so who am I then in those circumstances to say they shouldn't have been there, just from my own rather sort of particular cultural viewpoint.
Anything in that form?
Yes, my wife was responsible for organizing one of the Sharabang outings that the bishop's wives went on to Burswood, which is a Christian hospital outside Tunbridge Wells, where we live in Kent. And about 50 of the spouses came in a coach one day, and they had lunch, and they walked in the grounds. All shades of opinion, all shades of religious belief, she suspects, all colours, and they all had a jolly good time.
Well, if that describes the whole thing, that's something.
If that was the purpose of it, yes. I mean, what one did hear was a certain amount that some of the arguments and disagreements that were playing out amongst the bishops were certainly playing out amongst the spouses, and at the risk of being slightly contentious about it, often with amongst people who had even less theological framework in which to conduct those kinds of debates. So they were often, from what one heard, even more unbecoming conversations, but I think one's got to be quite careful about that.
Well, it's very appropriate that a bishop should have the last word, or almost
naturally.
The last word. In fact, it is, of course, the case that Anglican clergy are immensely devoted to their bishops and bow as they pass in the congregation, but of course have a rather stranger internal reaction to them, and the thought of asking them questions about doctrine in the General Synod, searching questions, is an interesting one. One also has to remember that in 1964, of course, the House of Bishops condemned premium bonds as immoral, and then did this again, I think, in 1992 when the lottery was launched. I went straight out and bought a ticket and won £10, and I thought that happened every week, actually. But but anyway, I found this debate enormously frank and refreshing, and thank you both on behalf of everybody here. We're most grateful to you. Thank you. Just to say that other debates are on the programme, and there'll be more coming into it. I might just draw your attention to the fact on this Thursday, curiously it's not here, this Thursday evening, the Bishop of Liverpool is delivering a lecture about Christianity and the environment at 7 o'clock for the Feast of St. Francis at around this time of the year. You'll be most welcome.